Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a little while, we'll speak with Paul Street, who is the author of The Empire's New Clothes, just out from Paradigm Books, about Brand Obama, the disappointments thereof. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by a frequent guest on Behind the News, Christian Parenti, who had a piece in The Nation a little while ago. Didn't get to interview when it first came out, but this is not exactly time-sensitive material about what the U.S. government can do to hasten the development of environmentally friendly technologies. So it doesn't have to be any kind of slick innovation or creation of new technologies, not at all. No, they can just buy differently and act differently and create vast economies of scale that could bring about a private sector revolution as well. We'll talk to Christian about that in a little under half an hour. But first, some words in the news. No miracle cures featuring Scientology promoting convicted credit card frauds, or tales of Illuminati planting chips in your heads today, I'm sorry to say. Instead, I bring you gloomy news for the economy, which is a lot less exhilarating. Since I wasn't here on WBAI last week, just a quick reprise of what I said 7 days ago to a different audience. Then I said that the evidence of an economic slowdown continues to roll in. The immediate evidence, then, was the rise of the number of new applicants for unemployment insurance, a number that had already been creeping up for the previous 2 weeks after falling for most of the year. This week's number was down, but it's still at a very high level. Putting us all these recent trends together, it's looking like the weak job gains of the last few months, they were weak, but at least there were gains, could turn into losses this month or next. That would be very bad news, both as a measure of the state of that abstraction called the economy and for the human beings involved. This week also brought shockingly bad news from the housing market. Everyone expected that the expiration of the federal first-time home buyer's tax credit, which a lot of people get an $8,000 refund in their taxes if they're buying a house for the first time, everyone expected that the expiration of that would lead to a fall-off in sales, but nothing this sharp. Sales of new houses fell 12% in July, to the lowest rate in the 47-year history of that series. Remember, that includes years when the population was a lot lower than it is now, too. And sales of existing houses, a far larger market, fell by 27% in July to the lowest rate in 15 years. The National Association of Realtors reported that delinquencies and foreclosures mostly declined in the second quarter from the all-time highs set in the first. The share of mortgages on which foreclosure proceedings were started fell to their lowest level since the end of 2008, though it still would have been a record at any time before 2008. To put some numbers on this problem, something like 1.3 million people live in housing on which foreclosure was started last quarter, and about 5.3 million are already living through foreclosure proceedings. Another 7.3 million live in a seriously delinquent situation, that is 60 to 90 days past due on their mortgage, for whom foreclosure could be imminent. Yes, all these numbers are down a bit from the previous 3 months, but they're still horribly high. Delinquency and foreclosure numbers tend to lag the broad economy, so this recent decline probably reflects the mild economic recovery we saw earlier this year. As that recovery weakens, we can expect these numbers to rise again. Sure enough, the share of mortgages just 30 days past due, that is, people who are just freshly entering the realm of the troubled, rose in the second quarter, the second consecutive increase after declining through 2009. Housing typically leads the broad economy in both up and down cycles, so this is not good news. And since this crisis was unusually housing-centered, the bad news is really doubled. And the portents for the future are looking worse, too. In the housing market, the number of permits issued to build new houses, which for obvious reasons tends to lead the broader housing market, fell 4% last month and is now 18% below the high set in March, the peak of the tax credit-inspired mini-recovery. More broadly, the weekly leading index in the Economic Cycles Research Institute, designed to forecast changes in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, fell last week, extending a weakening trend that's been in place since April. It's now looking more likely, though it's not yet certain, that we could lapse back into recession. And if not that, then the recovery, such as it was, isn't even running on fumes anymore. I've been saying that for the last few months that we were in a weak recovery that would feel to many people like we were still in recession. We may now be on the verge of something worse. Okay, let's take a musical break and talk about Brand Obama.
Don't be shy. Get up, dear. Don't be weird. Get up, dear. The boys are here.
that's some of Sparks' music that you can dance to from the Idol album of that title back in 1986, the first of the All Sparks musical interlude today. Now we're joined on the line by Paul Street, who is the author of a new book called The Empire's New Clothes, an examination of Brand Obama and his disappointments. Welcome, just out from Paradigm Publishers. Welcome, Paul.
Hi there.
So, tell us, you open your book with an interesting analysis of Obama as brand. Certainly we've gotten familiar with the presidential campaign as a marketing operation, you know, going back to Joe McGinnis's book. But this seemed unusually brand-oriented, didn't it?
Well, you know, I saw it in Iowa. It was quite extraordinary. We've elevated images and marketing notions above actual policy issues in American politics, I would say, since the 1830s, you know, the Jackson era, Tippecanoe and Tyler II and so forth. But it reached a level of science in the 20th century, and now it's just off the charts. You know, Obama was given the Marketer of the Year award by Advertising Age, the leading advertising industry trade journal, in 2008. It was quite appropriate. We sell our candidates like we sell toothpaste, like we sell cars. You know, they do one thing and the brand gets us to believe something else altogether, and which was to feel good about our candidates and our politicians. It's amazing. Large majorities don't vote for presidents or other candidates on the basis of policy, basis of issues so much anymore as they do on the basis of feelings.
And there's that striking...
You want to have a beer with, yeah, right.
Yeah, that striking O logo, which has achieved real iconic brand status and, you know, change and that...
change, which, by the way, were the two key words of James Carville's 1992 Bill Clinton campaign, along with "It's the Economy, Stupid," and a little bit of touch of health care reform. It was almost exactly the same exact thing. The politicians have been running on the campaign of change since time immemorial. I was watching the History Channel a few months back, and they showed Winston Churchill's return, the arch-conservative Winston Churchill's return to power in the 1950s, and he was campaigning from a balcony in London, and behind him was a banner that said, "Vote for Change, Winston Churchill."
That's what they call a floating signifier. It means whatever you want it to. But you also say at the beginning of the book that when you were canvassing for Edwards, another rather troubled candidate, at least he was saying some right things. But as you were canvassing for him in Iowa, teach at University of Iowa, right?
No, I was the freelance author in Iowa City at that time. I wasn't teaching at the university. No, the university was just completely nuts for Obama.
But as you said, as you're canvassing, when you encountered Obama supporters, they just couldn't tell you why they supported him. Other people would engage you in conversation,
It was very pronounced. My son was a field manager for Edwards, and he talked me into helping him out a little bit, and I ended up, I realized I was going to write a book about the Obama phenomenon. It struck me it might be useful to do that. Plus, Edwards was running in a very angry, sort of populist, pro-labor way, and so I agreed. But one of the shticks you do when you come to the door and you call people on the phone is, "Who are you supporting?" And they tell you, you know, Biden, Dodd, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Dennis Kucinich, whatever. And you go, "Who is it?" And they go, "Why?" And invariably, all of the candidates, except for Obama, would give you two or three particular, specific policy-related reasons that they wanted their candidate in. With Edwards, it was very often the Employee Free Choice Act, and oftentimes you were talking to someone from a labor background. The Obama people seemed almost angry at the fact that you had the temerity of the spot to even ask that question. It seemed to be self-evident to them that sort of His Holiness, the Dalai Obama, was the next savior and the ultimate icon of progressive change, and it really didn't need to be explained or talked about in any way. It was very pronounced, and I talked about it. I talked about it with canvassers, not only the Edwards campaign and the other ones, the Hillary people and the Dodd people and the Kucinich people. And we were all struck by it. It was something very different.
What do you attribute this to?
You know, I was just utterly mystified by it, and it struck me that it might have something to do with instructions from Chicago, and I talked to a couple of Obama people since, and I was told that there was this sense that if you tell them anything about what we're for, they'll steal it. The Edwards people will steal it, and the Hillary people will steal it. I don't know if that was it. There was also this kind of, there were some instructions to their supporters to that regard, but I can't believe all the supporters got those instructions. I was in an academic environment. I was in a campus town mainly. And it was a very strong identity-based connection to Obama because of his perceived eloquence, his perceived hyper-intelligence, and the fact that he was himself a constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago. I think it was a mixture of different things, to some extent instructions from above, and to some extent just a kind of sense that this is sort of who we are. I think the extraordinary thing about Obama was his capacity. About Team Obama and their campaign, which is absolutely the most spectacular campaign outfit that ever rolled through Iowa, to get people to identify themselves with him in a very personal kind of way.
He was very fortunate in running in the wake of Bush, who was obviously an inarticulate and ill-read fellow. He is a very articulate and well-read guy who seems to think and seems cerebral and reflective. So at least people who care about that sort of thing were able to latch onto that.
Yeah, the university towns were pretty strong that way. I noticed that on more than one occasion. Yeah, we now have an intellectual president. And even folks who were less of Obama say, well, he knows our analysis. He understands where we're coming from. And I've always sort of been skeptical about that as something to be excited about insofar as it's true. He did pick up a lot of the sort of left labor critique. He gets a lot of that from his days in Chicago and his relatively short career as a community organizer. But being in and around semi-progressive circles on the south side of Chicago, I'm not sure it's all that great, though, because it sort of equipped him, as any president has to be, or any presidential candidate who wants to be viable has to be, they have to be a corporate, and they have to be imperial, and they have to be military, and they have to be nationalist, and they have to be institutionally white supremacist, whatever their skin color may be, and so on and so forth. We got those things, and to actually know how some of us on the left think may actually be a problem for us, because he knows how to screw us over and co-opt us and bamboozle us more effectively than maybe Hillary Clinton would have. Or
there's so few of us, so why bother?
What's that?
There's so few of us, I wonder why I bother.
That's true, and there's less of us over time. That's right, that's true. But you do, particularly in the primaries, there does seem to be some real effort to bamboozle and bring along less progressive insofar as we exist and have influence. And it was pretty clear in Iowa that there were attempts to sell this fellow. Noam Chomsky's a little bit wrong when he said that there's no basis at all for people to have had any progressive expectations of Obama. I mean, if you follow the campaign like I did in a pretty up-close way, in 07 in Iowa, it's all happening before it's happening in the rest of the country. The only place that comes close is New Hampshire to that. There really were all these signals that were being consistently sent out that this was an anti-war candidate. This was a non-corporate candidate and a people's candidate. Some of that was being pushed left by Edwards.
But that was also in very measured...
Both Hillary and Obama in Iowa. Edwards scared them with a populist message.
That was all in very measured language. I mean, even his opposition to the Iraq War was, he's against this war. He was very careful about how he worded these things, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. And for people who wanted to do any kind of elementary power elite-based due diligence research on the reality of this candidate, there were countless signals that were sent out, speeches given to the Chicago Council on Global Relations, to the Council on Foreign Relations, to NASDAQ, to various capitalist groups. And there were numerous pieces, not just by leftists like myself or you or Glenn Ford. I mean, there's a long list of people who are warning about Obama. There's a number of pieces by people who are not particularly left-wing in any kind of way, like Larissa McFarquhar in the New Yorker in May of 2007 and others. And then there were Obama's own writings in his book, Audacity of Hope, that were just loaded with clear messages of centrism and corporatism and imperialism and nationalism, and the reluctance of people who call themselves left liberals to look at any of this stuff and to take any of it seriously was just absolutely astonishing. And I just sort of stood there in Iowa in 07 with my jaw dropping open, watching people thinking and projecting and believing things out about Obama that I personally knew to be thoroughly untrue because I worked in Chicago for many years at a relatively conservative organization, a civil rights organization on the South Side, and dealt with Obama. And you don't rise up in Mayor Daley's Chicago and Rod Blagojevich's Illinois, and you don't get approval from K Street and Wall Street when you run for the Senate in 2004. By being some sort of starry-eyed idealist who wants to change America in left progressive kinds of ways. But the stubborn insistence that he was that sort of person, that he wasn't a man of the left, as I heard many people say, it was almost religious. It was a branding that it was fairly futile to try and undo.
I was quite surprised to read in that mostly debased book, Game Change, by Mark Halperin and John, whatever his name is, that almost on the moment of his arrival in the Senate, Obama was groomed by the Senate leadership. Harry Reid called him in and said, "You're not really a senatorial kind of personality. We want you to run for president." Yeah, he is not the insurgent outsider. He was really groomed by the leadership from the outset.
And what's more, he comes in and immediately picks, this is self-chosen, he picks Lieberman, this sort of neocon pseudo-Democrat from Connecticut, immediately to be his mentor. When you're a freshman senator, you have to have a mentor. And very quickly, by the midterms in 06, with Rahm Emanuel's support, Obama is lending his already considerable campaign finance muscle to pro-war versus anti-war Democrats in the 2006 congressional primaries. I have a chapter in this book I just did called The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. It's called We Were Warned. It's chapter 6. And it has about 25 ways in which anyone who was paying serious attention could have seen that this new war president, that were given warnings that Obama would be a corporate and war president. And that was just one of many that he went around in 06 like that. There were votes in the Senate on tort reform. There were votes on credit card interest rates. They were all very corporate and made things very clear. And there were things he said about Iraq that he qualified his so-called Iraq war position. And he voted for the Iraq war in 05 and 06 quite, you know, I could go on and on with that. We wouldn't have time. It was all sort of there. To pick Lieberman, you know, was very, very interesting. He went out and campaigned for Lieberman against Ned Lamont in Connecticut, told the Ned Lamont people that Ned Lamont beat Lieberman, that he would be there for Ned Lamont in the general election with his campaign finance largesse and his charisma, and he wasn't.
I'm speaking with Paul Street, who is the author of The Empire's New Clothes, just out from Paradigm Books. So all this is a way of prefacing the fact that you were not really disappointed by the first year and a half of the Obama presidency, right? You're pretty much
you
expected.
No, it's all thoroughly, and it's almost worse in some ways than I expected.
Well, what parts are worse?
Well, you know, it took Obama less than 1 year to become the all-time kingpin of corporate welfare. He took the Bush bailouts of the parasitic financial institutions, you know, to a new level. What's it, $13 trillion or thereabouts in the first year? I sort of, my eyes glaze over when I think about it. The immediate sort of advanced drop kill of anything in the way of a peace dividend, an auto restructuring deal that actually rewarded capital flight. No movement whatsoever.
Yeah, that auto deal, you quote, I think, Floyd Norris, The New York Times, saying it was amazing to see a president supported by unions come up with such an arrangement. This is a lot of people on the right perceive the auto deal as a bailout of labor, but it wasn't. It was no such thing, right?
It was no such thing, yeah. And at the same time, labor leaders are telling David Greenhouse in The New York Times that American workers don't feel the need in any particular kind of way to need to engage in the sorts of things that they do in Europe, you know, direct actions and boss nappings and workplaces and workplace occupations because we have a more effective way to bring about change in this country, and that's called elections.
Yeah.
Numerous labor leaders that said this to Greenhouse is an interesting article in, I think, May of 2009. And, you know, the list of these types of things goes on, but again, we were warned. It was very interesting. In 08, the general election, Obama was in Ohio, and he was promising that he was going to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement with strong labor and environmental protections. And at the and at the very same time, his economic advisor, who then was a sort of a centrist right neoliberal named Austin Goolsbee, who was a friend of his, you know, from the arch conservative University of Chicago, was caught telling the Canadian government, you know, their conservative officials at that time, you really don't have to worry about this rhetoric. This is just the kind of crap that candidates that are really backed by corporations have to say to get working class votes in the United States of America. Don't take this seriously, Goolsbee told Canada, because you just have to say this stuff to these sort of pathetic deindustrialized proletarians in the Rust Belt. They don't get elected, and he won't do any of that. I mean, the power elite talks one way to itself and another way to us.
Well, yeah, this is one of the things that strikes me about people who are always complaining about the weakness of the Democrats, their spinelessness. You know, they really are a party that is a party of capital, but sometimes has to pretend otherwise. And so it sometimes ties it in knots, but this is why they behave that way.
Well, you know, there is this sort of phenomenon of the one-and-a-half party system, or the two wings of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce party, and we all like to say Coke and Pepsi on the left, and I've said that much of my life, but they're not exactly the same either. They're not identical parties, and the Democrats do have constituencies that the Republican Party doesn't have. I do think that the economic aristocracy or the capitalist elite or the ruling class or whatever you want to call them, all things considered, would prefer to have the Republicans in power as much as possible. But the Republicans have this remarkable propensity to do egregiously awful and stupid things like Watergate, which, by the way, was fairly unnecessary. And then, of course, we had the totally over-the-top messianic militarist Bush-Cheney fiasco. So the brand has to be pulled out every once in a while. You know, the Republican brand has to be pulled back, and the other one has to be put out front. Kevin Phillips used to call the Democrats history's second most enthusiastic capitalist party, and they've got to go out there. But it's still a problem for them. It bothers them a little, because they do have urban and working class constituencies that big money people aren't happy with. So there's a different response from the right and from the media when we have Democratic presidents, and there's all these bizarre lectures to Democratic presidents that Republican presidents don't get about the need not to be driven by ideology, the need to steer to the center, and to watch out for big government and big deficits. Well, the Republicans drive big government and deficits. And they drive them through intense motivation by ideology, right-wing ideology. You know, it's the tax cuts for the wealthy that drive deficits, and they have huge repressive and military programs that drive deficits, and those lectures never come. So it's been fascinating to see Obama come in, serving Wall Street, serving corporate interests, betraying all the progressive constituencies he seduced in the election, very much like Bill Clinton in 92 and 96, and like Democrats through time immemorial. It's what they do. And to get repeatedly lectured about the need not to be a socialist, because, you know, that's what he really wants to be, which is totally false.
Yeah, now this is an important issue, because there are a lot of people who will concede that Obama is not everything they were hoping for, but his opponents are so awful that you have no choice but to support him. So what do you say to that?
It's this, right, you know, and to carry further, that he's doing the most he can on behalf of so-called progressive values in this big, mean environment of corporate power and Republican right-wing harassment and so on. There's assumption that somehow he's alien to all that corporate power and all that military nationalism and all that right-wingness that is based on a false conception of him and his earlier career. It doesn't have anything to do with who he really was. What I did in my first book, on Obama, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, was take a look at his early career, really all the way back to law school. This is a guy who was more than happy to accommodate not just the moderate right, but the far right at Harvard Law School, with the Federalist Society, who were to become sort of the seat of these arch right wing neoconservative justices that we have in the federal system right now. More than happy to accommodate them and to piss off minority students and less students at Harvard in order to become the editor of the Harvard Law Journal. I watched Obama in Illinois, where I was based, and in Chicago, repeatedly take policy studies and various other issues and things that I was working on, and then go work with the Illinois Manufacturers Association and the GOP and Republicans, many of whom he was very good friends with, poker buddies with down in Springfield, and concoct and craft sort of fake progressive bills that diluted most of the content of anything that would have made any real particular kind of difference, including reducing a bill for universal health insurance in Illinois in the late 1990s down to nothing but a promise of someday there being a blue ribbon commission that might explore the possibility of having universal health insurance in Illinois. And he got high praise from lobbyists and all that. In the campaign rhetoric in Iowa, which is community organizer, this community organizer, that, and nobody seemed to know that he hated being a community organizer. He thought it was a losing proposition. He wanted to get out of it. You know, it was a pain for him. he complained to his mentor, Murray Kellerman, I'm going to be a loser, you know. So I have to go join the Power Elite if I'm going to effectuate any particular kind of change. So, yeah, there was this desire to believe things and not to look at other signals, not just from leftists, but even from... there's this remarkable essay in May of 07 in the New Yorker by Larissa McFarquhar called The Conciliator. And she has in-depth interviews with Obama and portrays him as, in her words, deeply conservative. She says almost Burkean in his discomfort with deep structural change of any particular kind. So there's this false assumption that he's compromising anything to the left by a... That he's compromising any particular principles when he bends to the right, based on a false conception of where he's coming from. And then the furthermore, insofar as it's true that if the left progressive gets in and they get destroyed by the power elite control, the lobbyist control, the military control of the political structure, that kind of suggests that maybe somebody running for president. I mean, if that's what happens to a left progressive, let's assume he was a left progressive person, okay? Let's assume that's really where he's coming from. Then we get him in, and he's just a bailout artist, and he's cutting, you know, a health care bill where he completely ignores the progressives on the advice from Rahm Emanuel, and it's a bill that only the big insurers and drug companies could ever love, right? And it strips out anything that went really remotely progressive, and except for some marginal things and so on and so forth, and that's what happens. Then maybe it's not about running for president. Maybe it's about rebuilding social movements, expanding social movements, and it's about a politics of changing the culture of politics. Maybe it's about a politics of electoral reform so that we actually could be left, that we actually could have left candidates. We can't right now. We simply can't. Under the existing system, electoral politics is, I think, largely, except at a local level perhaps, a dead end for left progressives. I mean, I hate to say that, but I'm afraid it's true.
No, I think you make a very good point. And we only got a minute left. I did want to ask you this question, if you can answer it in 45 seconds. Where does this leave people like
what
us?
What is to be done?
No, not so much what is to be done, but the situation that we're in with Obama, a lot of people still in this apologetic mode. Is there a way out of the box, or we'd have to live with this for another couple of years?
You know, I tell you, with the right wing consistently attacking him from the right, it's very difficult to advance a lot of critique right now. I think we have to continue to try anyway. I was amazed in Ottawa, the campaign was having how strongly people identify with individual candidates, and then when they become the presidents, they identify very strongly. I think we continue to try forthrightly but politely to tell the truth about Obama, who he is and where he's come from. But furthermore, at a certain point, we're not going to get through it. We have to challenge people to have a different concept of politics, that it's not just about candidate-centered stuff and great men theories of history or great women theories of history, that it's about a politics of pressure. You know, Howard Zinn used to say, it's not who's sitting in the White House, it's who's sitting in. We're not politicians. Politicians cut deals. Politicians are pragmatic with concentrated power. We are citizens, and we are about telling the truth. And we need to build the kind of social movements that will push these guys to the left, like the industrial workers movement did with FDR in the 30s. I know this is a standard kind of progressive thing to say, but I know any way around to say it. Like the civil rights and the anti-war movements pushed, you know, LBJ in the 60s. We still have to do that kind of work regardless of what people think about Obama. If they want the delusions about Obama and we can't strip them away from them, that's fine. But please join us in that social movement for progressive change.
Okay, we got to stop there. Thanks for joining us, Paul Street, who is the author of The Empire's New Clothes, just out from Paradigm Publishers. All right, let's take a station break, and we'll be back to talk about the big green buy.
Hi, my name is Alitza. When I'm in New York, I always have my radio tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. And when I'm back home in Bulgaria, I listen to the web at WBAI.org. Здравейте, аз съм Елица. Когато съм в Нью Йорк, аз винаги слушам WBAI 99.5 FM. Когато съм във Варна, България, аз слушам WBAI радио на интернета на WBAI.org.
I wish I could say something in Bulgarian, but I don't think I can. This is WBAI, not only on the radio at 99.5 FM in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you pledged during our recent fund drive, thank you very much. Please make good on your pledge. And if you didn't, you can always hit the donate button on our website and juice up our cash flow during these lean months. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be right back. got some of Beat the Clock, Sparks again, produced by Giorgio Moroder from, I believe, 1979. The great Giorgio Moroder. And now we're joined by Christian Prenti, who had a piece in the July 15th issue of The Nation. My time rushes by. The Big Green Buy. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. My condolences on the passing of your father, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it's not easy. A lot of people who talk about climate change focus on the need for transformative technologies. Everyone's talking about how we need the big breakthrough, whether it's solar or some yet unknown thing or some kind of clean version of nuclear power or, just some magic bullet that's going to save us. You think there's more mundane ways to go about making some progress?
Yeah, I think that whole discourse of technological breakthrough is deep in our culture, but it's also used to delay just getting down to business and shifting investment away from fossil fuels towards the existing technologies that are already in use that could potentially repower this economy and the world economy. And those technologies are, wind power, solar power, geothermal, tidal kinetics. And the problem right now is that, by and large, clean tech, electric vehicles as well, is a bit more expensive than old, dirty technology, electricity from coal, gasoline-fired automobiles. And the old, dirty technology is more competitive at its price point, in part because of a history of long subsidies. I mean, fossil fuels, it's hard to estimate, it varies, but in this last decade, got $72 billion worth of subsidies. So that's part of it. But it's also just that there are economies of scale for the old dirty technology. And so it's necessarily cheaper. Everything is cheaper when you buy in bulk. So what has to happen for clean technology to break through, for it to become cheap enough so that people will buy electric cars rather than gasoline-powered cars, is there has to be, this price gap has to close. And what the article is about the role of government potentially in creating those markets for clean technology by simply buying the technology. And thus, that would be a good thing in and of itself, but it would also create economies of scale that would close the price gap and then catalyze a massive adaptation of such technologies on the open market, because they would be cost competitive. And only when clean energy and clean technology is cheaper than or the same price as dirty technology, only then will the economy make the shift.
Let's focus and go back to that point about innovation before we get to the procurement issue. You quote Tocqueville saying this is an American obsession. He's going back to the 1830s. So how much of it is this kind of ingrained response, an ideological common sense reaction, common sense in the sense of the things that are pounded into our heads from youth? And how much are there real material interests involved in this focus on innovation?
Well, I think that it's the audience that receives the message receives it willingly and gullibly because it resonates culturally. But those who are broadcasting and crafting the message usually have pretty powerful financial interests behind it. Take an example, which I don't use in the article, but like the hydrogen car, right? That's just a complete non-starter. It's a ridiculous technology. It's you make hydrogen by running electricity through water. You get water when you burn hydrogen. It's essentially a really, really complicated, highly dangerous battery, and it's never going to work. But the fossil fuel industry, the automobile industry, oil companies support hydrogen as this, future fuel thing, precisely because it's not going to work. So they're defending themselves, and they love this idea of the breakthrough technology, and what you need to do is give various corporations huge blank checks to do R&D forever and ever while they continue selling, the fuel that they have now. And these corporations, the oil and coal industries, have tremendous sunk costs in all of this infrastructure, and they're not interested in giving it up at all. So I think that the message is crafted by interests that seek to delay any real transition towards a clean economy. But the general discourse in the society is just, people don't think critically about the idea of, like, you know, whiz bang technology, and they don't think critically about how commodities actually reach mass market.
And you mentioned the example of microprocessors, computers, which the government really very heavily subsidized the research and development of those things. It's now a tale of the brilliance of American entrepreneurs, but in fact the government was behind it in the early decades.
And
but
also
the procurement angle is very important, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because the government didn't just subsidize the R&D, it was also, and still is today, one of the main consumers of these technologies. And you see that also in aircraft, which is one of the areas where the U.S. still has a trade surplus, and it's a very healthy industry. And there's lots of innovation and profitable companies. And the government is still one of the largest purchasers of jet aircraft and helps drive the aircraft sector, not just by subsidizing R&D, but also by driving down costs through creating mass markets and economies of scale.
It is interesting that the industries where the U.S. is still really strongly competitive, aerospace, pharmaceuticals, computers, software, and even agribusiness, these are all areas in which the government continues to play a very large role, has mm-hmm. for a long time and continues to. So these tales of plucky entrepreneurship are badly misplaced.
Yeah, and to Bill Gates' credit, who has his hand out looking for R&D money, he wants R&D on clean technology to triple from $5 billion a year to $16 billion. To his credit, he has been going around saying, you know, actually the government funded a lot of what Microsoft now uses. That history is quite hidden. But you think about the role of the government in the economy, and I think also the left kind of sometimes shies away from it because, you know, just this kind of an inheritance of anti-communism. People don't really like to talk about state power. They don't really know how to deal with it unless you're condemning the government for putting people in orange jumpsuits and torturing them. But the government, state, local, and federal government, constitutes about 38% of the U.S. economy. So, and next year, the government will spend about $3.6 trillion buying stuff, buying electricity, buying vehicles, buying paper, building buildings. So you think about what an enormous bit of leverage that is. How much could be done if the federal government started buying only electricity from green sources like wind power and hydrokinetic, you know, plants, that sort of stuff. It would do tremendous things for the economy. And the good news is that Obama did, he passed an executive order requiring federal agencies to buy 95% green in their procurement and to come up with systems for monitoring and analyzing how to reduce their carbon footprints by a pretty significant amount. I think it's like 28% by 2020. There have been executive orders like this since the Clinton era, but they've never had specific targets and goals. And so what's happening right now is these agencies are beginning this process of analyzing themselves to figure out what can we do. So, for example, the General Services Agency, which is like the federal government's janitor. It manages the buildings. It does a lot of the bulk purchasing of things like cleaning products and carpets for other agencies in government.
Pocket protectors and brown shoes, you say, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty square agency. But, you know, they're taking this quite seriously, and they have, in fact, reduced their consumption of energy. They're working on, having their staff fly less, drive less, stuff like that. Other agencies in the federal government, from what I could tell from my reporting, are, you know, like this executive order might as well be written in Bulgarian. I mean, they don't really understand what it's all about. And there was just an extension for the agencies to submit their plans for how they're going to do this. So, and in my mind, this article somewhat links to another article I wrote this spring for The Nation about the EPA and how the EPA could do a lot to cut carbon emissions. You know,
let's talk about that for a minute, because that's an important point, and it often gets lost. Everybody's waiting for some bill to come out of Congress. It looks like nothing's going to come out of Congress on climate change. What could the EPA do?
There is, this is the thing people remember. There is already enabling legislation from 1970. It's called the Clean Air Act, you know, and also the Endangered Species Act. And a number of other acts that the EPA is charged with enforcing. And the EPA activists in the 90s sued the federal government to force it to consider greenhouse gases, six greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide being the main one, as dangerous to human health and therefore requiring EPA regulation. That took 10 years for that to finally become law. It became law under Bush. He ignored it. And refused to implement it. So then under Obama, Lisa Jackson at the EPA has moved forward with the endangerment finding, saying indeed these greenhouse gases are dangerous and so we have to regulate them. What it could do is basically put a de facto price on carbon, say, you know, these are dangerous, they're going to destroy the, you know, its civilization if we allow people to keep burning these filthy fuels. So any company that does this, any power, any utility that continues to burn dirty coal will be fined massively. And that will then cause private money to move away from expensive, what would then be expensive coal, towards cleaner technology. And the EPA has moved forward slowly. The first thing they did was about regulating tailpipe emissions from vehicles, because that was never done at a national level. And they're moving forward slowly with these stationary sources, but their limits for what's considered dangerous levels of emissions are probably going to be quite high. But what they could do is just say, you know, basically, like, every coal plant is in violation of air pollution laws, and you either shut them down or pay massive costs of fines, which is to say, de facto carbon price. And there's numerous other ways in which, you know, I mean, CO2 is absorbed by the sea, and the oceans are becoming more acidic, and so this is endangering human health and fisheries. And there's tons of other ways in which the EPA can force a transition.
Now, a lot of congressional Republicans and other forces of orthodoxy would like to strip the EPA of its power, right?
Right, and they tried. Lisa Murkowski led that fight, and she was defeated. And so the effect, I don't think that's going to happen, but the effect has been to scare the Obama administration into reining in Lisa Jackson, who's the head of the EPA, who, by all accounts from environmentalists, you know, she's actually pretty good.
Even the best of people can only do so much in this government, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, who has written a couple of articles for The Nation on these climate issues, but most recently, The Big Green Buy, which in the July 15th issue of the magazine. All right, now let's talk back to the procurement question. You've got some numbers in here that show just how big an actor the federal government is. Was it 650,000 buildings or something? Like just enormous amounts of office space, vehicles, mm-hmm. enormous energy consumer, mm-hmm. mind-boggling numbers.
Mm-hmm. The largest energy consumer in the world, and also the largest single purchaser of vehicles in the world. The post office has 150,000 vehicles, the vast majority of which would be perfect for electrification because they basically drive in a 20-mile loop every day and park in the same place at night, so you could easily plug them in to charging stations. And the post office is slowly moving towards electrification, and there's no reason they should not they should ever buy another gasoline-powered vehicle.
Now, you have the example of a company that makes electric trucks, mm-hmm. these sorts of vans that would be perfect for the post office, mm-hmm. and they're having to get like custom-made parts, right?
Yeah,
they can't move in scale. So right. How would this change things?
Well, the Smith Electric Vehicles based in Kansas, they have plans to. Well, right now they produce about 20 electric trucks a month. And they have to buy, like, the wheels, the wire harnesses, the chassis on the open market. And the CEO told me that if they could order things in batches of 50 and 100 rather than 10, they could cut their costs on some components by as much as 30 or 40%. And they have plans to open more facilities around the country. And really what they need, and what was interesting was even he didn't really think that much about this. He's tried to get the the U.S. military to buy some of these trucks, and they have four of them, and they're experimenting with them. But the U.S. military also has 160,000 non-tactical vehicles, basically just trucks that are never going to go overseas. They just drive around military bases, you know, and those could be
delivering hot dogs and things.
Yeah, delivering hot dogs and cleaning supplies and whatever. You know, and so what would really be good for him is if the federal government put in an order for, you know, 100, you know, or 1,000 trucks a year for the next 10 years. That would, like, make his business. And right now, these electric trucks from Smith Electric Vehicle are almost competitive with gas or diesel-powered trucks. They're a couple $1,000 more. And so the federal government has
to buy the truck or operate them?
To buy the truck. But to operate it is much cheaper because electricity is a fraction of the price per mile that diesel or gasoline are. But it's a matter of coming up with this the money up front, and it's a couple extra $1,000. It's actually, I think it's more like 20% more. But then there are these layers of grants that the federal government is offering that kind of gets the price down. But what this guy really needs is economies of scale. And the federal government could provide that without having to play games in the Senate, you know, searching for 60 votes. They could just do this by purchasing, and maybe they will. I mean, maybe that's the implication of this executive order, and, you know, hopefully that will happen. Interesting also, after I wrote the article, I learned that the post office was in the position of having to go to China to buy vehicles and batteries to electrify its fleet. So there's that whole issue, too, of, like, reindustrializing the U.S. economy.
This would be a great jobs program as well as an environmental program.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we could reach these economies of scale on these electric trucks, then, what, FedEx and UPS would come along,
right,
too, right?
Right. Then once it was, you know, once the price of a delivery truck, an electric delivery truck, was equal to that of a gasoline-powered truck, and one can imagine that there would be also the price of charging stations would drop as more and more of those were built by the government. Once those prices are even, then it would make perfect sense for any large company to buy electric vehicles.
Because the operating costs are so much lower.
So much lower. And also electric motors are require much less maintenance than internal combustion engines. So there's savings in terms of the operation, the maintenance, but and certainly in terms of the fuel is much cheaper.
Now, you mentioned something that the valley of death, which is that point in a product's life cycle after the venture capitalists have done their work, before it achieves mass adaptation, or adoption, rather, there's this very difficult valley or hump to get through, right?
Yeah, the valley of death is what technology developers refer to as the time between the invention, when there's a lot of capital usually for inventing something like a cell phone, a flat screen TV, or some sort of wave power power station, whatever the thing is. There's frequently money from the government, from startup funds, whatever, to invent these things. And if you have some sort of a gadget that is on the market and competitive and profitable, it's also, there's usually money to borrow to expand your business, or you want to sell your business. There's people who want to buy it. But it's that space in between where there's a dearth of capital, and that's the valley of death, from working prototype to actual victory in the market. And that is what the federal government and local and state government purchasing could do, is help close the price gap and cross the valley of death by creating markets and economies of scale for vehicles, batteries, green power, and also new, you know, businesses that are retrofitting buildings and designing cleaner buildings. Buildings use an enormous amount of electricity, like a third of all electricity or more. I think it's about 37% of all power is consumed by buildings. And they're, as anyone who lives here in New York knows, they're tremendously inefficient. And there's a whole industry waiting to be born around retrofitting buildings and saving enormous amounts of money for the building owners, and also cutting massively down on the carbon footprint. Also, you know, new buildings can be built in ways that they actually generate energy. particularly in hot climates with solar and all that. And the federal government is doing some of that. But the problem is all of this stuff is so small scale and prototype, you know, it's at the level of prototype. And all the initiatives proposed in Congress are ridiculous, you know, like Ed Markey and some of the electric vehicle champions are now working on legislation that is just so unbelievably complicated and sort of stupid in the, like, layers upon layers of subsidies and tax rebates. And, you know, really what the federal government needs to do is just buy electric vehicles. And that will do far more than $30 million here and $1 billion there. Another thing...
We have to clear out early for the World Historical Candidate Statement. So just in the 45 seconds we've got left, what's stopping this?
What is stopping this is, you know, I don't quite know. I think that some of it's cultural, but I think it's also the reluctance to spend a little extra up front for federal agencies. They're afraid of doing that. And I think it's just the inertia of the kind of the things they have. And then also there's the fact that the fossil fuel industry is attacking at every level, everywhere, and pumping the entire society full of crazy propaganda around, you know, denying climate change. And I think those attitudes infuse the federal bureaucracy and that many of them just don't take this seriously and don't want to think creatively on how to transform their agencies.
All right, we got to stop there. Thanks for that. Christian Parenti, author of The Big Green Buy in the July 15 issue of The Nation magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, also from Sparks. Till next week. Bye.
And also voices spewing propaganda. Might this right to be wrong or right to better?
Propaganda.
Come to our side, she does say. Come on, mother, she does say. When they don't need more competition for her affection, you should fight on over there. Where's your will to act like an indent? Propaganda. Where's your will to fight to know what's wrong in my head? Propaganda. Come on over, you will hear. In a voice that comes in tear. Then I think that you will see that you've been moving. Let us fight on over there. Duck that little boy, that missile whistle like a propaganda. Keep your powder dry, no we shall away from propaganda.